2BCB with a question.
2BC, I'll get to you in a second. Well, Paul, I don't think the solanol is absorbed through the skin. I think it's more of a GI tract problem. It gives you a stomach complaint, and some people actually are very sensitive to potatoes. Unless they're fried or they're boiled, some people just get sick when they eat potatoes, unfortunately. But I'm not familiar with the solanol producing a contact dermatitis, if you will. I guess it's, anything is possible.
Okay, very good. Understood. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. 2BC?
This is K2BCV, Gene and Selden. I just wanted to make a comment. The nightshade varieties of vegetables is very, very detrimental to some people, that, and it causes arthritis. Dr. Roy, go ahead.
Okay. Well, you know, like I said before, there's a lot of foods out there. If you take them in small measure, you have less of a chance of having side effects from the somewhat noxious material. The nightshade is the nightshade family is kind of famous for their group of poisons. So you know, there are toxic materials produced by potatoes, produced by stone fruits, produced by a lot of things that we survive on. So, you know, all things in moderation. It's probably best to spread out your nutritional food supply into different things than to specialize in one or two things. I think that's generally a given nowadays, and unfortunately that's not the way most people work. They get a favorite, or worse, they get a diet plan where they say live on a potato and only a potato. So I would agree to kind of spread out the different types of foods that you eat. It limits your risk.
Very good, Roy. Thank you very much. Take care. 7-3.
Okay, very good. Anyone else with any questions or comments on this subject before I move on to the next one?
N2RDB.
Yes, N2RDB.
People need to be careful with their terminology. Because, you know, okay, let's use the term organic as an example. People love to get things that are organic. They're organic, they're healthy, they're good for you. Okay. There are a lot of things out there that are organic. Canine feces is one of them, and you won't see people standing online to get it. Petroleum products are organic. And if you ingest those, they will kill you. Coal tar, same thing. Highly toxic, but it's used for treating certain skin conditions when applied topically. So you have to be careful in what you say is organic, for example. And as for what's healthy, it's, you know, even with a lot of things that are healthy, like, for example, we all need small amounts of copper, selenium, zinc, trace amounts of those metals, manganese, magnesium, etc., 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 but too much of some of those things can be highly toxic. Anyway, that was my two cents worth. N2RDB, back to that.
And it's a fine point. I'm trying to get people to understand that the way that people are using organic these days is more as a marketing theme than anything related to science whatsoever. In science, organic chemistry is the chemistry of almost everything that contains carbon atoms as part of the molecules. Whether it be naturally occurring in nature or synthesized, organic chemicals just need to have a carbon in them. So as far as chemistry is concerned, there's no inherent benefit with organic chemistry. A lot of organic chemistry can be quite poisonous and can be quite deleterious. The same way with naturally occurring chemicals, and all this is chemistry. be it organic in the terms of coming from natural food and biological products versus made in a vat. They're all chemicals. Some are beneficial. Some of them are the same for all intents and purposes because you can synthesize all kinds of good stuff. Some are beneficial. Some are noxious. So calling something organic, unfortunately, to a scientist means almost nothing. It just means that it has a carbon atom to me. It doesn't mean that there's an inherent benefit on it because it's organic. But to the general public, they've unfortunately been taught by ad agencies that organic is good and synthetic is bad. I hope that's the takeaway for today. There's nothing particularly wrong with taking water-based food supplements if you can afford it, and it's not costing you too much. The worst comes to worst, you just have expensive urine. Don't go too heavy on some things like oil-based vitamin A and vitamin D, because too much of that can produce toxicities, and even too much vitamin C can cause kidney stones. And other GI tract problems. So all things in moderation. Be guided by common sense and of course, your doctor's opinion when you talk to them or your regular physical exam, which I'm sure all of you go to. Anyway, anyone else with any questions or comments on this subject before I move on to the next subject? Yes, Rich.
Even in moderation, how evil is sugar?
Well, you know, one of the telling things, I think, is that you can put a pound of sugar out for a year, and it never goes bad. That's not good. There's a bunch of reasons why it doesn't go bad, because it's has no water content, so anything that attacks it is going to be by osmosis. Basically blown up by it, but there, you know, there is no particular need for pure sugar, except that we have evolved to really love fats and sweets, and so that's the way to make sweets sweeter. In the old days, it was cane sugar, which was probably a slightly better version of simple sugars. Now we've moved, unfortunately, to corn starches, which are a less healthy variety, because sugars are not a single thing. Sugars are a classification. A bunch of molecules are saccharide molecules. And there are monosaccharide molecules, there are disaccharide molecules, and they all taste sweet to us. Polysaccharides are what we call starches. Which don't really taste like much of anything because they bind each other and block our receptors for the sweet reception. So if you broke down starch, it too would be sweet. But generally speaking, if you have food that contains carbohydrates, that's good. If you eat a lot of added sugar, that tends to be bad because we're not really designed for that. And it's probably one of the many reasons why diabetes is as incredibly, the incidence of diabetes these days is ridiculously high.
With diabetes, if you don't have it by the time you're 60, let's say, can you still get it, adult onset or whatever it might be called?
Adult onset can strike you at any age. It tends to be more environmentally positioned. There are people, I've had patients, where if you actually are able to talk them down to a reasonable weight, you don't need to give them the magic pills or insulin. You can just watch them and just monitor them. And when you can't get them down to that weight, sometimes all you need is pills. Other times you need pills and injections. So if you take a 60-odd-year-old man who is at his ideal weight, but he has a tendency, his glucose tolerance tests are kind of iffy, but ultimately it's not a problem. and you feed them with a lot of molasses and a lot of corn syrup and get them an extra 100 pounds, chances are pretty good that you're going to push him over the edge and he'll have clinical adult onset diabetes, or as we call it these days, stage 2.
What you're saying is that someone who otherwise is healthy and never been diagnosed with diabetes can eat enough sugar, I don't know if fat comes into it, but could he eat enough sugar to, if he or she wanted to, actually cause themselves to have diabetes? Is that what you're saying?
You increase the chance of expression of diabetes. That's why I kind of added, doctors do these things, glucose tolerance tests, where they have a person swallow an amount of sugar and then they test their sugar serum levels throughout the day. And there are people who just can't quite handle sugar as well as the next person, but clinically they don't have any of the hallmarks of diabetes, so they're said to be at risk. If you take those people at risk and then you assault them dietarily, you're going to kind of force a lot of them over the border to diabetes. I'm not saying that if you took, say, 165-year-old men who were perfect height, perfect weight for their height, and gave them a sugar diet and raised them to 100 pounds heavier, that 100% of them would develop diabetes. There are lucky people out there. There's a certain percentage would auto-correct their ability to maintain their internal sugar control, whereas others less talented in that way will just spiral into diabetes.
Lastly, how could you put a multiple on it, like a multiple of 10? How bad, or the ratio of sugar you get from fruit versus sugar you get refined sugar?
Well, I would love to give you an absolute number, but none to my knowledge exists. Again, natural forms of sugar tend to be less problematic than a single type of sugar molecule that's all you're getting out of corn syrup and nothing else. So if you spread it out, you're probably a little bit safer than if you center on the same stuff in large quantities. So I wish I could give you a magic number. I can't. Just the general suggestion is it's a lot better to eat naturally sweetened things than artificially sweetened things. And even though the Corn Growers Authority would not like anyone to say this, it's probably not a great idea to take in a lot of sugar through corn syrup type of products.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, once again, any questions or comments on this topic before I move to a completely different subject? Okay, it is a problem that plagues even the priciest of lenses manufactured to the most exacting specifications. The center of the frame might be razor sharp, but the corners and the edges always look a little soft. It's a problem that's existed for thousands of years with optical devices, and one that was assumed to be unsolvable until a Mexican physicist developed a mind-melting formula that might revolutionize how lenses are manufactured. On paper, a curved glass lens should be able to redirect all the rays of light passing through it onto a single target known as its focal point. But in the real world, it just doesn't work that way. Differences in refraction across the lens, as well as imperfections in its shape and materials, all contribute to some of those light rays, especially those entering the lens near its outer edges, missing the target. It's a phenomenon known as spherical aberration. And it's a problem that even Isaac Newton and the Greek mathematician Diocles couldn't crack. Now, new improvements in design and manufacturing, including the use of additional aspherical lenses that can help counteract and correct the spherical aberration effect, mean today's lens-building techniques come very close to producing uniformly sharp images. These lenses don't have a perfectly spherical shape and can be very expensive and difficult to manufacture and design, as lens makers essentially have to experiment and come up with a different aspherical shape for every application. But that's all going to change thanks to a guy called Rafael G. Gonzalez Acuña, a doctoral student at Mexico's Tecnológico de Monterrey. After months of work, he managed to come up with a mind-melting equation that provides an analytical solution for counteracting spherical aberrations, which was previously formulated back in 1949 as the Wasserman-Wolf problem, which stumped scientists for many decades. Let me drop for a second. Now, this is a doozy of an equation. I will give a link to the article, which has a image, which is a very, very big image with a lot of squiggly lines. And if you think Bessel functions are problematic on the radio, it's got nothing compared to this. It's sure to give most of us a migraine pondering, but for lens makers, it can provide an exact blueprint for designing a lens that completely eliminates any spherical aberration. It doesn't matter the size of the lens, the material it's made from, or what it will be used for. The equation will spit out the exact numbers needed to design an optically perfect lens. The breakthrough won't just appeal to picky photographers who've been plagued with minor focus issues, no matter how much money they've invested in their gear. It promises to help improve scientific imaging as well in devices like telescopes and microscopes, where improved sharpness could lead to other discoveries. But even the average consumer will benefit from Gonzalez Acuña's work. It will allow companies to design and manufacture simpler lenses with fewer elements, which cost considerably less, while offering improved image quality in everything from smartphones to cheap point-and-shoot cameras. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
So what's holding it up? I mean, you know, if this all works, you know, you think they would have a manufacturing plant going and start making eyeglasses and start making, you know, lenses for telescopes. I mean, the formulas work, but he just hasn't done it yet. He hasn't actually developed the lens. Is that the problem?
He's a theoretician. He doesn't develop lenses. He just gave the equation. It's been published. It's now up to optical scientists in different walks of life. You know, the people at the Jet Propulsion Lab and people who make microscopes to read the article, ponder the equation, write algorithms for it for computers, plug in the numbers, get the answers, make assessments, run tests, and start to cut lenses. These things don't happen instantaneously. So hopefully, in a matter of time, like any new technology, it will start to permeate through the system. It just, you know, it takes time for anything. There's a lot of technological inertia that goes on. There's a lot of people who have spent a lot of time and money researching other lens designs that they probably want to stick to amortize the amount of money that they spent on it. So there's a lot of things that kind of slow down the wheels of technology, unfortunately.
Okay, I get it. Very good. So, you know, sooner or later they'll develop this. Do they say what the difference is? In other words, if you could, you know, if you could put a micrometer on it or something, is the outside spherical part of it, you know, thicker or thinner or just different light layers or something different than what we normally have? You know, do they give you information on that? How's it going to look different, the lens itself?
Well, the old method was to design non-symmetrical lenses made out of different refractive elements and piece them together with very complicated mathematics, modeling, and tweaking. This would kind of obviate most of that. What simply they would do is plug in the refractive index of the material, the spherical characteristics that they wanted, and it will spit out an approximate design that they just run it through the equipment that shapes the glass, and it should improve the degree of the lack of spherical distortion of the new lens design. So this is a kind of a new equation to calculate in a much cleaner, easier way future lenses that don't require complex non-spherical shapes, which are more difficult to manufacture.
Okay, it sounds very promising. Now you take somebody like me with I look through without glasses. If I see one small LED light, you know, I might see 20 LED lights. You know, and then with the glasses, you know, that'll shrink to maybe about 5 or 6 or something like that. So this sounds like that would even correct it more. You know, you could take that information and maybe get something to focus even better for each individual customer. Like you said, you can take the formula and just plug it into whatever they're looking for. Sounds good. Back to you.
It's one of those things that if it pans out, which it should, it is going to improve the quality of equipment and decrease the price of it, which is important. I don't know how many people kind of play around with microscopes, but in my life I have. The amount of spherical aberration in a microscope can be very annoying. Not too bad if you just use your eye, because your eye has that little fovea, so you just need to move it around a lot, and you can kind of work around the spherical aberration. But if you've ever seen these microscopes that have a camera, a video camera on it, and they put it up on the screen, some of these lenses that really have problems with spherical aberration look awful at the edges. It's just everything gets fuzzy and vague. So things like that are definitely going to have an improvement, and camera lenses as well. And they hopefully won't cost you some ridiculous thing like $5,000 for a fluoride, aspherical, complex lens that had to run through supercomputers and then modeling for 6 years.
Very good, very good. I wonder if his name's going to be on your site. I should look this guy up. Back to you.
Yeah, Paul, I'll put a link to a very nice article on the subject, and I think it has a picture of him, and it has a picture of the equation, which is an awful-looking equation. I mean, you know, there are some equations that are quite elegant. E equals mc squared, almost everyone knows that one, although it's a special case. And it's not really Einstein's major formula, which is a lot more complicated. It's written in shorthand. This is definitely not in shorthand, and it'll be very intimidating to just about anyone, including a lot of mathematicians. But it's very intriguing, and hopefully it'll actually come to fruition and prove itself, in the realm of actual manufacturing, which is an important thing. There's a lot of things that scientists find out and then can't bring it to market because of a whole bunch of complicating things. Graphene being a perfect example at this point. But if it's just a computer algorithm, it's just a matter of tweaking it and programming it on specific machines, and away you go.
Very, very good. Tomorrow I'll go to roy.ac2gs.com and look it up.
Hey, very good. I usually put in the links right after I go off my little science talk. So anytime anyone wants to check out the link, it should be, assuming that I finish up by 11 o'clock like I planned, It should be on my page 10 minutes after 11. So let me move on to the next subject, unless anyone has any questions or comments on the previous one. Okay. Gee, it looks like you can't even trust Russian government sources these days. Saying ain't so, Boris. A Russian city reportedly observed a rise in radiation levels after an explosion at a nearby military testing site, which left at least two dead. Reuters reports that the Russian Defense Ministry told state media that a liquid propellant rocket engine exploded on Thursday, killing two people and injuring six. Quote, at the test site of the Russian Ministry of Defense in Arkhangelsk region, when testing a liquid propulsion system, an explosion occurred and the product ignited, end quote, the Defense Ministry told the Russian news agency TASS in a statement. The ministry claimed there were no harmful emissions into the atmosphere. The radiation background is normal, end quote. But the city of Severnik, which has a population of 185,000, reported a spike in radiation at noon. It's unlikely that a liquid propellant rocket explosion alone would cause a rise in radiation levels, leading to speculation about what really might have happened. Another Russian agency, MASH, shared photos and a video of what appeared to be emergency responders in hazmat suits and Geiger counters and a person being moved to an ambulance. Unconfirmed reports on social media claim victims were treated for radiation exposure. A Russian news outlet, 29.ru, reported that residents of the city of Severnik and Arkhangelsk, is difficult to pronounce, guys, have been scrambling to buy iodine from pharmacies, many of which have sold out. Potassium iodide can hinder the collection of radioactive iodine-131 in thyroid glands, which can cause cancer, as anyone who's watched Chernobyl will understand. According to Reuters, an authority of a port of Arkhangelsk said the explosion led to the closure of a portion of Divina Bay in the White Sea, so it can no longer be used for shipping. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2, yes.
GIS query.
WB2BXO. Does that mean this could have been an accidental nuclear detonation?
Frank, we'll get to you in a second. Bill was first, although he didn't reply when I called him. But Bill, you wanted to say something.
Yes, sorry. I just heard noise on my end. I did not hear you calling back to me. But I thought that there was a official Russian agency, Rus something, I forget the name of it, that admitted that this was a test of a nuclear-powered engine, that they had not admitted it when there had been a previous failure, basically the same kind of type, but this time that there was an official admission. Have you not heard that? I thought that was the case, but still... things did not seem to add up entirely to me. Supposedly, the system was powered by a quote-unquote nuclear battery, which to me means is produced, and then the action is from electric motors, which, I mean, I don't think that would be practical or efficient. But back to you. What have you heard along those lines, AC2IS?
Okay, I haven't heard, I haven't really looked the last day or so. This was a report that I think came out around Friday, so I didn't look over the weekend. It's possible that they either made up another lie or someone came up with part of the truth, because definitely, you know, liquid propellants don't give you a high radiation count, so there's something radioactive that went boom. Going back to Frank, I don't know if it was a thermonuclear explosion per se. It could simply be some device which used fission in some way that when kablooey and sprayed the area with radioactive decaying material.
This is AC2ISM. So people have speculated.
Okay, very interesting. Sounds like there could be a lot of implications. Turns out to be WB2B.
Strike location. This is a nuclear powered cruise missile, not, you know, I presumably also with a nuclear warhead, but not necessarily, but that it would have a nuclear propulsion system. I mean, they also said, you know, even though there was this nuclear, quote unquote, nuclear battery rocket, powered rocket, that there was not a risk of radiation getting into the atmosphere, which again is clearly not the case. So there's still some, you know, partial, what I thought, partial admission, partial fabrication in regards.
Did some after that agency shut us down? Don't hear anything. WB2BXL.
Hey, thanks, Bill. Thanks, Frank. Unfortunately, I don't know exactly what's going on with Echolink, because usually with Echolink, if there's someone talking on the repeater, it doesn't allow the person on Echolink to transmit. But this configuration seems to allow people to transmit, over the person who's transmitting on a radio to a repeater. So I heard you, Frank, intermittently. I guess you didn't hear Bill when he was talking, but I don't know. Once again, this is a wonderful example why, unfortunately, there are some countries where you can't believe any kind of governmental agency 100% of the time. At this point, I'm wondering whether you can believe the Russian agencies 1% of the time, but eventually, maybe we'll figure out exactly what went boom. It's possible that it's the nuclear-powered cruise missile, although I tend to think that might be a hallucination on Boris's part as well. It kind of goes along with him boasting about something that he doesn't seem to have any particular proof. Who knows? It'll be interesting to find out as this story develops over time.
ACQIS again here. I didn't hear the beeps, but it seemed like enough time had gone by for them to be beeps. My understanding is that the United States had this technology in the 1960s and abandoned it because basically it was just horribly dangerous, and even under the best cases there was enough radiation that escaped these systems that it did not make sense to use them. AC2IS.
The closest technology to this that I can recall historically is they were working on nuclear-powered base generators to run engines in airplanes. So in some way similar to nuclear subs, they were considering building nuclear airplanes. I guess they could be designed to operate missiles if you were mildly crazy. But that was one of the liquid salt technologies that they were looking into that they then were considering thorium as an option for molten salt generators. But it's old technology. It's not very clean technology, and I'm not quite sure if it's real technology over there. But we'll sort of see. It's kind of, they have a lot of radioactive stuff out there. It's basically, unfortunately, you can say that Russia is a gas station with nuclear missiles and nuclear bombs. So they got lots of nuclear stuff. They can put it in all kinds of interesting things, and occasionally they have this nasty habit of things blowing up on them. and then you get higher radioactive levels in the area. Okay, any other questions or comments on this subject, or I'll move on to the next one. Okay, Boeing, you remember Boeing? Boeing may have a solution for the 737 MAX flaw discovered first in June. Both the AP and Seattle Times claims the aircraft maker is developing new software that will take in input from both of the aircraft's flight control computers to improve its reliability rather than one at a time as it does these days. This would both address the newer issue and increase the trustworthiness of the MCAS system, whose fatal errors prompted the jet's grounding. The scoops also indicated that just what the June flaw apparently entails. Reportedly, a microprocessor in the 737 MAX wasn't sufficiently protected against the consequences of random bit flips, that's a zero changing to a one or vice versa. While this would be extremely unlikely, it'd be the result of cosmic rays hitting the chip. It supposedly took too long for pilots to recover under realistic conditions. The update would require both flight computers to fail at once for these bit flips to lead to catastrophic events. Boeing couldn't confirm or deny the reports in a statement to the AP, instead repeating the message that it's working with the FAA and other regulators to fix the June flaw. It still intends to offer the fixed software for testing in September and hopes to return to the air as soon as October. Whether or not that happens isn't certain. Boeing was maintaining its summer goal mere hours before the June flaw itself was first made public. There's no guarantee that regulators will give the 737 MAX a clean bill of health, and a resumption of flights will still depend on smooth real-world testing as well as regulators' approval everywhere the aircraft will fly. It could take a long while before the airliner fully resumes normal flight. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. Just in case anyone thinks I own stock in Airbus, with all the Boeing stories I've been talking about, here's an example that even clever people can make really stupid mistakes about Airbus. Having to occasionally reboot a sluggish laptop after a few days of use is a minor inconvenience for a $1,000 gadget. But what about a $300 million-plus commercial plane? Airlines who haven't performed a recent software update on certain models of the Airbus A350 are being told that they must completely power cycle the aircraft every 149 hours or risk, quote, partial or total loss of some avionic systems or functions, end quote, according to the European Union Aviation Safety Agency. Unless being completely taken out of service for repairs or maintenance, most commercial airliners remain powered up and operational for weeks on end as they crisscross countries or the world. With hefty price tags and operating costs, an airline's profitability is dependent on its fleet of planes being in service for as long as possible, even hauling passengers and cargo around the clock. Unlike a laptop, which can be power cycled in a few minutes, it can take well over a half an hour to bring a powered down airliner back to being fully operational and flight ready. Let me drop for a second. But airlines operating older versions of the Airbus A350-941, which was introduced back in 2013, are subject to a mandatory airworthiness directive first issued in 2017. It has now been revised by the European Union Aviation Safety Agency to require them to completely power down the aircraft before it passes 149 hours of continuous operation. The directive comes as a result of a known software bug that's related to the plane's internal timer that could potentially trigger some concerning side effects if not properly reset and resolved with a power cycle, according to the European Union Aviation Safety Agency's Airworthiness Directive. depending upon the affected airplanes or systems or equipment, different consequences have been observed and reported by operators, from redundancy loss to complete loss on a specific function hosted on a common remote data concentrator and core processing input-output modules. This condition, if not corrected, could lead to a partial or total loss of some avionics systems or functions, possibly resulting in an unsafe condition, end quote. The bug can be remedied with a software update that Airbus includes on newer A350-941, and which can be applied to older versions of the aircraft as well, but does require the plane to be taken out of service for maintenance and quality assurance testing, which would take longer to perform than a simple power cycle does. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, no comments about Boeing, no comments about Airbus. I guess Hank's not listening tonight. Very well, on to the next story. Well, gang, put on your propeller hats for this new theory about dark matter. This one requires a whole new class of particles that have never been proven to have ever existed. So that sounds like fun. Physicists don't know where most of the universe's apparent mass has gone, and attempts to find it have so far failed. But a proposed particle born out of the universe's chaotic first moments may provide a candidate and a reasonable way to look for it. This proposal suggests that dark matter formed before the Big Bang, but in a jargony physicist sense of the phrase, the hypothetical particle does not actually predate the universe itself. Instead, what's exciting, that is comparatively simple, dark matter theory is compatible with the decades of tests that have constrained what dark matter might actually look like, as well as with present-day understanding of the universe. Now, most importantly, this theory is actually supposed to be testable, which will be loads of fun to watch. The candidate particle leaves a unique imprint on the large-scale structure of the universe, that is, on the distribution of galaxies and galaxy clusters, the study author Tommy Tenkanen from Johns Hopkins University has claimed. This makes the hypothesis testable with astronomical observations in the near future. To reiterate the idea of dark matter, basically, astronomical observations of distant galaxies and the universe's structure imply that there's some source of gravity permeating the universe that experiments can't directly detect. This gravity source far outweighs the matter that makes up Earth and all the universe's stars and galaxies. Scientists call this stuff dark matter, even though today's dark matter candidates aren't as much dark as they are transparent. Particle colliders and detectors buried deep underground have failed to find conclusive evidence of any dark matter candidates, the most popular of which are called WIMPs, or weakly interacting massive particles. Let me drop for a sec. Tenkanen instead theorized that things called scalar particles formed as the universe was rapidly inflating during its first infinitesimal fraction of its first second, not before the start of the universe, but just before the start of the era that some physicists call the Big Bang epoch, which occurs after inflation. During this inflationary period, fields called scalar fields could have filled the universe, and if the inflation itself wasn't uniform, it might have introduced fluctuations to the field. These fluctuations correspond to massive scalar particles that can only interact with matter through gravity and would still exist today. According to the theory, WIMPs, unlike their scalar products, would have formed after the inflationary era was over. This probably sounds the same as every other dark matter candidate you've ever heard of. It's a particle we haven't discovered yet, but it's supposedly elegant in its details, in that the particle fits within the existing constraints of what dark matter can and can't be based on. Experiments and observations of the most distant visible light called cosmic microwave background. Plus, it was devised using similar mathematical tools to those that govern Higgs bosons, another particle that corresponds with a scalar field. Let me drop for a sec. This theory is one of a number of similar theories, according to Tenkanen's paper published in Physical Review Letters. However, this paper shows for the first time that a theory like this can work without conflicting with cosmic microwave background data. And all of that is exciting. What's so refreshing about the latest paper is it's possible to put together a model of dark matter that relies less on thoroughly untested hypothetical ideas that still matches many of the observational constraints we need dark matter to meet, said David Kaiser, professor of physics at MIT. The paper itself is not a discovery, of course. It's just a theory, which is more or less the physicist's term for a mathematical consistent hypothesis, but it also provides a signature for astronomers to look for in the sky and could falsify the hypothesis if disproven. If dark matter interacts too strongly with itself, then the theory doesn't work. It also predicts certain small changes to the universe's structure that would appear in upcoming telescopes. Tenkanen predicts that the Euclid dark matter mapping satellite might be able to provide some of these answers once it's launched in 2022. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, no questions about scalar fields. And scalar fields apparently do exist because the Higgs boson is a scalar field. But we'll leave that for hopefully some other night. On to the next story after this pause. Okay, the Cuban death ray story seems to get squirrelier and squirrelier as time goes by. Scientists are still unsure of why a group of U.S. diplomats in Cuba experienced mysterious neurological symptoms, but they're still looking for answers. A new study published a few weeks ago in JAMA, that's the Journal of the American Medical Association, by the University of Pennsylvania, reveals the brain changes were found in the U.S. government officials who were stationed in Havana, but there's still no proof to the theory that the diplomats were attacked by a sonic weapon. The study performed advanced brain imaging on 40 government personnel who were stationed in Cuba. A group of 48 healthy patients were used as a control. Compared to the control group, the brains of the Cuba patients showed distinct differences in brain volume and connectivity. There was reduced white matter in the affected patients. Changes in tissue volume particularly impacted the cerebellum, the region of the brain responsible for executive functioning. The areas implicated in the patient's brain, namely the cerebellum, as well as the visual, spatial, and auditory networks, align with the neurological symptoms that were observed in the patients, said lead author Regina Verma, PhD professor of radiology and head of the imaging lab at the University of Pennsylvania. Verma said that changes were evident even after scientists excluded the results of patients with a history of brain injuries. Still, outside scientists cast doubt on the study, arguing that its techniques are far from ironclad. First off, the imaging methods used on the patients aren't meant to find diseases. Neuroscientist Douglas Field remarked in an editorial note, JAMA senior editor Christopher Muff and executive editor Phil Fontanarosa admitted that the paper didn't provide clear proof of impairment. However, despite the differences in advanced neuroimaging metrics between the patients and controls reported in this study, the clinical relevance of these differences is uncertain, and the exact nature of any potential exposure and underlying etiology of the patient's symptoms still remain unclear, they wrote. Let me drop for a sec. The study is a follow-up to a smaller trial the team performed back in 2016 with a group of 20 diplomats, which concluded that there were signs of neurological injury. That work was met with some backlash from the rest of the scientific community. 3 years later, it appears that the mystery of the Havana syndrome still hasn't been solved. But given how tricky investigating the phenomenon has been for scientists, it's probably best for the average person to avoid jumping to unlikely conclusions. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Gosh, I guess I've tired you guys out. Let me do one last story, and then I'll pass it off to Paul for the space report. A few weeks ago, an asteroid flew by the Earth coming as close as 44,000 miles away, and you might wonder how we seem to have missed it. Tabloids write weekly about the upcoming close asteroid approaches, hoping to spook you, but those asteroids are almost always already on our radar and guaranteed to miss the Earth. This asteroid that whizzed by during the night on July 24th and 25th was different. It was only discovered just before coming, perhaps a little too close to the Earth for comfort. A team at the Sonar Observatory in Brazil first noticed the asteroid a few weeks ago, and it appeared in another American team's data later that day before flying by hours later. The asteroid itself was between 187 and 426 feet in diameter, or as several astronomers have referred to it, a city killer. It was not a city killer, of course. It didn't hit a city and probably would not have hit a city had it hit the Earth. But the question remains, how do you miss something like that? Well, these asteroids are incredibly faint, and a few hundred feet might sound large if it pummels the Earth, but that's incredibly small on an astronomical scale. Even these rocks eventually get close enough that we can actually detect them, but surveys telescopes must be looking at the right place in the sky when the blips pass by. The United States Congress has been pushing NASA to detect and track threatening asteroids. In 1998, Congress told NASA to find the near-Earth asteroids larger than a kilometer in size within 10 years, and in 2005 expanded the goal to 90% of asteroids that come close to the Earth at least 460 feet in size. The world's asteroid finding infrastructure isn't able to complete even the 460-foot goal, according to a National Academy report released earlier this year. As yet, scientists only know about 30% of the estimated 25,000 asteroids that fulfill the congressional mandate. There isn't adequate infrastructure yet. Let me drop for a sec. We miss this object because we miss most objects this size range. Amy Mainzer, a principal investigator of NEOWISE Asteroid Hunting Space Telescope. Without new capability, most objects in this size range will remain undiscovered for many decades. Also, with only the visible light observations available, we have limited ability to say much else about the size or composition. There are probably other flybys out there like this, but we don't see them. The National Academy's report suggested pursuing a dedicated successor to NEOWISE called NEOCAM that would help accomplish this goal. After observatories noticed the asteroid, astronomers refound it in the Pan-STARRS observatory data going back to June 28th, once they knew it existed. But these older records were too faint for the system to automatically identify, explained Gareth Williams, associate director of the International Astronomical Union's Minor Planet Center in an email. Mainzer said that the astronomers must continue tracking objects like this in order to better determine their orbit and to see whether they pose a threat. In fact, Matthew Holman, director of International Astronomical Union's Minor Planet Center, chalked the whole situation up to a success. It would have been better to have found the Pan-STARRS observations automatically earlier, he said, but was happy that the independent observatories discovered it and determined it would be a threat before it flew by. To be frank, most of our world is uninhabited, so even if an asteroid of this size did strike the planet, it's unlikely it would actually have harmed anyone. Earlier this year, an asteroid created a large blast over the Bering Sea that went... that our Earth might be struck by something without enough time to prepare if it was necessary. This is something that you might be worried about, but perhaps it's a good time to call up your congressman and congressperson and tell them to prioritize funding a mission like NEOCAM. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
GXM.
Yes, Rich.
Approximately how big was the object that came within 44,000 miles of us?
Well, according to the report, they're rather vague about that. It was anywhere between 187 feet and 426 feet. But it's not a perfect sphere. It's probably some oblong thing that rotates, and so it appears to be different diameter depending upon the angle that you're viewing it. Other questions or comments on the subject?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
There was a project that they tried to get funded years ago, and yes, they'd still like to do it, called Sentinel. And the head of the group that was trying to do that is Rusty Swikert. You know, he's an astronaut. He was on Apollo 9, and he spent the rest of his life looking at the possibility of comets and asteroids hitting the Earth. And they you know, they developed the whole spacecraft. They know what it's going to look like. They know how much it's going to cost, but they can't get funding from NASA to do it. But the idea is that they plan on putting the Sentinel spacecraft between the orbit of Venus and Earth, just looking out, you know, looking out toward the ecliptic plane, and as it orbits, it'll. Each orbit would be less than a year, Earth year. But, in that time, it would be constantly scanning and documenting and cataloging, all possible threats to Earth, of the location between Venus and Earth. It's always looking out. And I always thought that would have been good, but Rusty Swikert hasn't been able to convince NASA to fund it. Back to you, Ross.
Yeah, that's fascinating, but we're stuck with the same problem we always are with NASA. The government really doesn't like paying those bills, and they don't like the budget. They like things that are flashy, things that have public relations benefits, much more than, finding out if some asteroid is going to whack us. So, as much as I love NASA, I've loved NASA since I was a little kid, and got loads and loads of public relations material in the mail almost weekly, if not, monthly, if not weekly. Their budget is very constricted, and I kind of understand what's going on with them. They have to make a best-case scenario. There's only a given amount of money, because you have to build those nuclear air carrier ships. I've lost track of how many billions of dollars each one costs these days. So it's a shame, but that's the nature of science. You have to have a good reason for budgeting every buck.
Yeah, okay. I believe I'm going way back now, but I think this was in the $200 million category. A little less than that, he said, which wouldn't be too bad, Yeah, I know the aircraft carriers. Well, I guess we need them. They're $5 billion. And then you need the fleet to go with them. You can't forget the fleet that goes with each aircraft carrier. Back to you, Mark.
Yes, indeed. So little money, so many toys to buy. I know that feeling well. But anyway... it's now past 11 o'clock, and it's coming up time for the Space Report. As always, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight, and even those who just quietly listened. I hope I amused, entertained, and informed you. I will be back next week with a whole bunch of new stories, and I hope I will figure out another puzzle question. As always, if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, if you have any topics for me, if you want to refute what I've been talking about, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And for links for most of the stories that I've mentioned tonight, all I have to do in about 5-10 minutes is go to my webpage, roy.ac2gs.com, and you can click it and read it to your heart's content after Paul's space report. So once again, thank you all. Thanks to Dick and thanks to Paul for giving me an opportunity. And now I'll pass it back to Dick so he can pass it over to Paul.
Thanks,
fine, Roy. Thank you. Paul, WS2N, K2LIW. Go ahead with the space report, Paul.
Okay, thanks, Dick. And this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, yeah, Roy, don't go away. You know, I have not as many topics as normal, so I know you listen anyway, but maybe we'll get to the end and there'll be some more room, unless there's questions or something. This week, there's a news conference NASA will hold on Friday,